want the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. You're about to hear from two heavy hitters in education, policy, and reform. On the left coast, Greg Duncan from UC Irvine, and on the east coast, Richard Murnane from Harvard. And we're going to discuss how income and other inequalities affect the outcome of our educational system. I want to thank the people who support this podcast through your subscriptions, like Gunnar Gunderson, Carl Hesterberg, Mark Shapiro, Michael Gill. They're all monthly subscribers. No, wait a minute. Mark Shapiro's an annual subscriber. At any rate, they support this podcast, and I'd like you to join them. Go to my website, peterbcollins.com. Just follow the link that says sign up. It's under my picture on the homepage. You can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever fits your budget. Or our best deal is the $50 annual subscription. And for new annual subscribers in the continental U.S., I've got a copy of the rockin' CD, Red Flag, from John Dist, and a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans supplied by Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. And the other way you can support us is by accepting the offer for a free one-month trial at audible.com. They'll reward you with your first audiobook download free, and if you cancel before 30 days, you won't owe them a penny. In any event, they'll send me $15 just because you tried audible.com. Today on the Peter B. Collins Show, we take a look at the American education system. Recent attempts at reform, and what we need to look at going forward to address very important issues of inequality, both in terms of opportunity and background related to students, schools, and teachers. We're joined today by two people, one on each coast, who are quite influential in researching and offering analysis of education policy. Here on the West Coast, Greg J. Duncan is a distinguished professor in the School of Education at the University of California at Irvine. Professor Duncan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And Richard J. Murnane is the Thompson Professor of Education and Society at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Professor Murnane, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And I just want to underscore for our listeners the depth of your studies and your own credentials. And starting with you, Professor Murnane, you're primarily an economist, but you have been studying issues of education, and you have collaborated with Greg Duncan on two books now related to issues generally around inequality.
That's correct.
And also, you are an expert on high school graduation rates. You have also been studying these income and inequality issues for some time. And likewise, Professor Duncan, I note that you have been publishing on these issues for, well, at least 20 years now, and have studied a range of issues, many centered around poverty and how it impacts educational opportunity and performance.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. So, if I may, first I want to say that your book is not an academic book. It's not the kind of thing written just by and for academics. So I want to acknowledge to you that you have written a very accessible book. It's under 200 pages, and you have provided, I think, some very interesting ideas that we'll discuss. But as we kind of set the table for our discussion, I wanted to ask each of you to help us understand your views on recent efforts in education policy reform. So, Professor Murnane, let me put you on the spot. And can you give us three good things about George Bush's signature education reform, No Child Left Behind?
I'm not sure I can get to three, but I can surely start. I think you need to look at this in a longer perspective. If you look, for example, when the National Assessment of Educational Progress was started in the very late 1960s. At the insistence of the nation's chief state school officers, there were no possibility of comparisons, and there was no possibility of data on how individual school districts, never mind schools, were performing. And we knew at that time, and we know even more, that children from low-income families, children of color, did not fare nearly so well in American schools as did more advantaged children.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't detailed information at the district or school level about this information. No Child Left Behind, by mandating that schools report detailed information on the performance of students by income, by race, ethnicity, by disadvantaged status, is extremely important in providing the nation with information about how well schools are serving children from different backgrounds. That's
mm-hmm.
a huge step forward.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulty, of course, is getting the accountability system right, and No Child Left Behind is a good start, but it doesn't have the incentives right, and one indication of that is that more than 40 states have been granted exceptions to No Child Left Behind by the Obama administration that allow them to use somewhat alternative provisions to the law.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a good step along a long path towards sensible accountability.
All right, that's one, and you indicated that getting to three might be a challenge. Is there a second?
I could jump in. You know, I think one of the beneficial aspects of No Child Left Behind is that it set goals not only for kids overall, but also for kids in disadvantaged groups. It tried to ensure that schools would be accountable not only for the general population of students, but also for subgroups of students who typically don't do as well. So I think for the first time sometimes, schools realized the importance of providing higher quality educations for groups of students who typically struggle more.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now I'm going to turn to you, Professor Duncan, because I wanted to ask you about three bad things or three reasons why.
Well, that's the easy question. Why didn't I get that one?
I just picked at random. I apologize.
That's okay.
So why did No Child Left Behind suck, if I can put it in street terms?
Well, I think Dick described the main reasons. It was a very heavy-handed kind of program, and it, as Dick says, it didn't really get the incentives right, and it's led to a lot of exceptions. I think what we need to do with school policy, the most important thing, is to improve the nature of the instruction, the quality of the instruction that's taking place in the classrooms. So we need to try to ensure with supports to teachers and with an accountability system that that high-quality instruction is taking place in all of our nation's classrooms. And if you've got an incentive system that's so at such a high level, school superintendents and school principals may understand what the goals are, what they're being held accountable for, but it's very hard for them to translate that into real changes that are taking place in the classrooms. that are going to be improving the nature of instruction on a day-to-day basis.
If I may, it's a pretty common criticism that No Child Left Behind was never fully funded. And the other side of it is that we've seen some schools and school districts attempt to game the system by cheating on tests, by fixing test scores. And so it seems that in many ways, it was a scheme that really didn't achieve its desired effects.
Well, could I speak to that?
Please.
So one thing in terms of, one thing is if you put people under enormous pressure to do things they don't know how to do, you shouldn't be surprised when you get dysfunctional responses, including teaching to the test or worse, as you have mentioned. So the trouble is we've been much better on accountability than on providing the supports to allow teachers to meet new demands on them. Now, just going back to provisions of No Child Left Behind, importantly, it lets states choose their own tests, and it lets states choose their own cut point for what proficiency means. And we know from comparisons of results on state tests with results from the National Center for Educational Progress that there's enormous variation across states in both the difficulty of the exams and the skills children need in order to acquire this rank of being a proficient student. And we see this, the Massachusetts looks very good. Many states such as Alabama and Mississippi don't look good at all in the sense that they have chosen tests that are not very demanding and haven't demanded much in terms of skills to be child to be declared proficient. So, for example, in, I believe, Alabama, more than three-quarters of the children are declared proficient on the state test, but you look on the National for Educational Progress for Alabama children, and it's and the percent proficiency is 18%.
Mm-hmm.
In contrast to Massachusetts, the percentages are higher on the NAEP than they are on the state test. So those are some of the problems with No Child Left Behind, and I think that's the reason why this movement towards Common Core standards supported by Common Core assessments makes an awful lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
Algebra ought to mean the same thing in Alabama as it does in Massachusetts, and what it means to be proficient in algebra ought to mean the same thing in the two states.
That's Professor Richard Murnane from Harvard. We're also talking with Professor Greg Duncan from UC Irvine. And you guys can pick who gets to take the good and the bad on this. Next, I'd like to ask you to comment on the initiative of the Obama administration and driven by Secretary of Education Arnie Duncan called Race to the Top, Good and Bad. Who wants to take the good?
Whichever you want.
No volunteers, so
I'll pick you,
Professor Murnane. Go ahead.
Well, again, and this is not something. This is a complicated issue. I think race to the top came at the time when states are absolutely desperate for funds for education, and the desire to get some of this race to the top money pushed states into accepting that teacher evaluation systems would be put in place. I think that's a good thing. Now, the difficulty is, how do you design high-quality teacher evaluation systems? And a lot of states are still struggling with that. But it was a good beginning. I also think it led to a pressure on states to allow more charter schools. I think in principle that's a good thing. But of course, how good a thing it is depends upon the extent to which charter schools and conventional public schools are on a level playing field in terms of funding and supports, and that varies across states.
Mm-hmm.
But I think these are provisions that made sense, and it must also be said, and some people criticize the Charter of Education for this, it also pushed states to adopt these Common Core standards that I think makes a lot of sense, because if you look at the countries that have done much better in international test score comparisons, they all have agreement on what children should learn in the whole country.
Mm-hmm. And Professor Duncan, what do you see as the negatives of Race to the Top?
Well, it's a piecemeal approach. You know, it was a voluntary system on the part of the federal government to entice states to put in place the kind of systems that it was trying to promote. So it's we have a very decentralized system of public education in the country, and I think historically that served us very well. But things have changed. One of the things that we talk about in the book is the extent to which technological change and globalization have really hollowed out the middle of the labor market and removed a lot of middle-class jobs that used to be available to high school graduates.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just those jobs aren't available anymore. So the kinds of skills that kids need to be graduating from high school or college with are considerably more sophisticated, not only in the conventional literacy and numeracy, but being able to write well, to communicate in groups, to be able to search the internet in a knowledgeable kind of way to find the valuable information and distinguish it from the junk. And so these skills are all quite a bit higher than used to be the case, and this federal initiative of Race to the Top is one partial way of trying to organize state systems to be able to focus more on that challenge, but it's only partial.
I had a fundamental problem with the idea of pitting one state against another, competing for a limited purse of federal funding.
So let's think about alternatives. The alternative would be the way it's done with Title I of Elementary Secondary Education Act, mm-hmm. where 14,000 of the nation's 15,000 school districts get some money for compensatory education, pretty much irrespective of their needs and of the quality of the programs they put in place with the Title I money. It doesn't sound to me like that's a better arrangement.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can understand that. I just think that, in relief, looking at it just in isolation, that you dangle money and get states to change their policies and their programs, and then some of them didn't even get any funding out of it. So I thought that was... It left some students behind, so to speak.
I think one thing to think about is the whole process of changing state systems of tracking student achievement and, in general, tracking the quality of education going on in the state. Few states have in place high-quality systems for doing that, and the way those systems usually spread is for certain states to take the lead to show that it's possible, and then through networking among state people, you can spread best practices across the country. So I think one of the things that that this Race to the Top initiative tried to do was to develop more models of best practice, which would then be disseminated across states that might not have won the initial competition, but would have available to them in a few years proven models for assembling and analyzing those kinds of systems of information.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now let's turn to Common Core. It's a buzzword. It is the kind of current wave in education reform. And first, let me ask you, Professor Murnane, just to give us a quick definition of what Common Core is and how it operates.
Well, it's a set of learning standards in English language arts and mathematics. So it's not curriculum. It's a set of quite parsimonious descriptions of key skills that children at each grade level should master in these two subject areas. And so, for example, there's a lot, in contrast to standards currently in place in most states, the Common Core state standards places much greater emphasis on having students know how to put together evidence in support of judgments they make after reading something, and being able to explain their reasoning both orally and in writing for and to develop a concrete arguments. Well, those are skills that make an awful lot of sense in a world in which the jobs that in the past have involved simply following directions are increasingly computerized and sent offshore. Now, the Common Core presents an extraordinary opportunity for the country. It also presents a challenge that I think is not widely recognized. We already know from evidence from New York State that has put in place exams that are supposed to be aligned with the Common Core, that children on average don't do nearly as well as they did on the prior exams. And we also see larger gaps by race and socioeconomic status than we saw on prior exams, because these are assessing more higher order skills. But I think that, and so that creates pressure on legislators and politicians to back off the standards, because it looks as if education system's not doing a good job. Well, it's not doing a good job because it's found it very difficult to keep up with these changes in the economy. But that really is what needs to be done. So I think sticking with the Common Core is a great opportunity for the country.
And Professor Duncan, what are your thoughts about Common Core, and do you see any negatives that should be addressed?
Well, I think Dick and I, for a lot of reasons that we try to spell out in the book, think the Common Core make a lot of sense. If you think back to this story of what's happened over the last 40 years and how the nature of middle-class jobs, upper-middle-class jobs have changed, it's not the case that the nature of jobs, skills required by jobs in Alabama are any different from the nature of skills required for jobs in Massachusetts. The kind of globalization of the economy has really set a uniformly high standard for all the states and the kids in those states. So. Before, we've had this piecemeal approach, local control and so forth, and I think what we're being forced to do now, by if we want a prosperous country 20 or 30 years from now, we need to have an education system that will provide kids with the kinds of skills that that they'll need to be able to work productively. And Dick talked about some of the literacy skills, but on the mathematics side, the Common Core is stressing conceptual knowledge as well as practical knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So they want kids to have the kind of conceptual knowledge that will enable them to apply what they've learned to new kinds of situations. So I think we're very supportive of the Common Core as an example of the kind of supports that teachers need to improve the quality of instruction. As Dick says, the rollout is very difficult because of the high standards in the Common Core. And I think one of the problems is that it's tempting, if you do go with the Common Core, to jump right away to holding schools accountable and teachers accountable for being able to meet Common Core standards. Now, I think eventually that's a very, very important goal, but it's going to take a while. Teachers need to have professional development. They need to have the kind of coaching to help understand how their teaching should change to accomplish the learning goals that are inherent in the Common Core. So that's going to take some time, and it's not really reasonable to hold teachers accountable for the performance of their kids according to the new standards until there's been this period, I hope it's not too long, for information, curricula to be developed using the Common Core, the assessments to be developed, all the kinds of instructional material that provide the key supports for the teachers to be able to teach at this higher level.
Mm-hmm. Now, Professor Murnane, correct me if I have the wrong impression, but in my reading of your book, you kind of cautiously embrace Common Core. I didn't pick up what I would call a ringing endorsement. Is that just because it's too soon to tell?
Oh, I think both Greg and I feel the Common Core is has great promise for the country, and I think the caution comes from recognizing the difficulties in implementing it well. You know, as part of the work we did in highlighting interventions that were effective in improving outcomes for low-income children, we've talked to lots of teachers and school leaders, and the overwhelming majority expressed two reactions to Common Core. The first was that they believe that the things that the Common Core asked children to master are the right things for the 21st century. They supported the concepts. The second thing is they're absolutely terrified that they will be asked to show that students have mastered that long before they will be able to develop the capacity to do just that. And so that's, I think, recognizing that is led to our realization of the difficulty, and that's what we try to express. Because, so for example, in the three interventions that we highlight in the book, and you can actually, if your listeners are interested in learning about them, we have 3 6-minute videos that describe these interventions, one at early childhood, one in elementary schools, one in high schools, on our website, restoringopportunity.com. And in all of these three interventions, the work of teaching looks very different than it does in most public schools in this country. In particular, classrooms are really teaching is a public activity in these successful interventions. Supervisors are in the classrooms very frequently, as are teachers' colleagues. They meet regularly and show each other the materials that they have developed. They look at each other, they look at videos of each other's teaching and talk about how to improve this. That's very different from what you see in most schools. And they recognize that effort is making a difference, but it's a long haul. And if you look at it in the context of other countries that have dramatically improved education systems, South Korea, Finland, these were multi-decade efforts. And that's not easy to stick with, given the politics of the U.S., but that's what it will take. And the caution comes from recognizing how difficult it will be to stay the course.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you, Professor Duncan, the Washington Post this week published a story, States Reconsider Common Core Tests, and the opening paragraph reads, beginning in March, more than 4 million students will serve as guinea pigs for the English and math tests for the Common Core, a set of standards adopted by almost every state that map out what students should know and be able to do in each grade. Ultimately, Common Core tests will be used to assess both students and teachers, and they are critical to the larger mission of the standards to increase academic rigor for all students and to allow states to better evaluate their students and compare them with those in other states. Is that a fair reading of the current situation and these tests that are coming up?
Well, as we said, the problem is all in getting from here to there. And I think we believe that the idea behind the Common Core, the execution of the Common Core in terms of the learning goals that have been developed are very important. The idea of developing good assessments based on the Common Core are very important. What's causing the problems now are the policies that, you know, we do need to see how kids now are doing against the Common Core standards. But whether we then hold schools immediately accountable to those new standards, whether we hold teachers immediately accountable to those new standards, that's what's problematic. And our fear is that that resistance to on that part about how do you actually use the information might lead to general dislike of the Common Core as an idea and a reversion. I believe that Florida is talking about coming up with its own alternative standards now to the Common Core. And that just gets us back to where we are now, which are very different standards in different states, in a national economy where everyone needs to have these higher levels of skills.
Well, and the Post article goes on to say that Kansas has withdrawn from there are two testing standards, PARC and Smarter Balanced. Kansas has withdrawn from Smarter Balanced, and Alaska is withdrawing from Smarter Balanced. Florida has ordered the state's education department to withdraw from PARC. So Georgia and Oklahoma withdrew from PARC. So what we have here is this attempt to create a national database for evaluation purposes, but those who are contributing the data are maneuvering in ways that will limit the effectiveness of the ultimate analysis. Is that fair, Professor Murnane?
I think that may be. In other words, that the trials of these assessments will not be done on a random sample of the nation's children because of these problems you've just described. And so that means the pilot testing will not be quite what you want. I mean, this is a result of the complicated structure of governance of education in the United States. I think, Greg, and I think these are complicate the implementation, but we shouldn't lose sight of the prize, that is having clarity about what children should be mastering at each grade level. And the teachers we've talked to in these schools that have been successful in educating high poverty student populations have emphasized, boy, the value of being clear what children should master at each grade level helps with our vertical alignment. That is, being clear what should be taught at each grade level. And that kind of concrete clarity is very helpful in planning instruction and in improving instruction.
Mm-hmm. You have a comment, Professor Duncan?
Nope, Dick said it all.
Okay. Let me turn next to the early part of your book, where you go into interesting detail, and you also present some individual cases that you actually followed over about a 15-year period. And let me focus on Anthony and Alexander. One is from a very blue-collar family with limited income, and sometimes meals are missed. And the other is a child who's growing up in the suburbs, whose parents can afford, $10,000 a year for soccer uniforms and music lessons and many other things that accompany a public school education and kind of accessorize it. And if you could, tell us a little bit about Anthony and Alexander and the way that policies, affect their opportunities and ultimately their performance. Let me start with you, Professor Duncan.
Yes, they were actually featured in a book by Annette Leroux called Unequal Childhoods, and we drew those examples to be illustrative of what the general data were showing about what's happened in the country in the last 40 years. There's been, because of these economic changes, technological change and globalization, high-skill worker families have gained and blue-collar working-class families have lost. So these Anthony Alexander are typifying what's gone on in the country as a whole. And if you look at the country as a whole, you see income inequality increasing, and you can actually look at the nature of what families are spending on their kids in terms of enrichment expenditures, lessons, music lessons, summer camp, high-quality child care experiences when they're young, maybe private schooling. What you see in recent years is that the 16 or so million kids in families in the top 20% of the income distribution have parents who are spending more than $9,000 per child per year on these kinds of activities.
Mm-hmm.
In the bottom 20%, those 16 million kids, the figure is more like $1,300. So there's a huge gap in the extent to which families can provide these kind of enrichment experiences. It's much bigger than it used to be. And what you see with Alexander, whose parents are well into the top 20% of the income distribution, is what a lot of upper middle class parents see, a very hectic kind of life because their activities are very much centered around their kids. They're taking them to soccer games and lessons, and they're really devoting themselves because they can afford to devote their time in weekends and evenings to these kinds of activities for their kids. For low-income parents, Anthony's parents, for example, things are very different because of the work that work hours. There's a single-parent family situation. The father's connected but not living with the mother. And those kinds of problems, coupled with especially the kinds of lower income levels, lead to a very different kind of set of experiences that Anthony and Alexander are getting outside of school. And I think one of the things that we try to emphasize in the book is how important those experiences are outside of the school for the way in which kids learn once they get inside school. Because it really helps, maybe not in the very early grades, but once kids are getting into fifth, sixth, seventh grade, the kind of background knowledge that kids bring to those grades are enormously helpful as they read novels, as they read science textbooks. The kinds of everyday understandings that that high-income kids are getting through their extracurricular activities that low-income kids aren't is helping to drive this wedge between the achievement levels of high- and low-income kids.
Your book also stresses the importance of pre-K education, and I will acknowledge that President Obama, in his 2013 State of the Union message, made a call for a universal preschool. I haven't heard a thing about it since. And this year, the kind of message point of the State of the Union, again, very important income inequality, is being addressed through the push to increase the minimum wage. And I am pleased that the president and the Democrats are addressing issues of poverty, which I think have been a very low priority, you know, even given the traumatic state of the economy when the president took office. So we can't escape the impact of many of these political issues and the failure to fix clear problems and address the need for universal preschool. The president has sounded the right themes, but can't seem to find the political traction to move forward on many of these. Professor Murnane?
I'm glad to try and answer that, but early childhood is one of Greg's specialties, so why doesn't he do that, and I'll add on at the end.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, Obama, President Obama did lay out a very ambitious initiative on preschool, and I think it's important, following on lines what we just talked about, to realize how big the gap is already at kindergarten, at the beginning of kindergarten, between kids from high-income families and low-income families. It's a huge gap. It's more than a year of school that low-income kids are already behind when they start kindergarten. And the idea of preschool is to provide education experiences before the beginning of school that would enable kids to, low-income kids to help catch up, and perhaps high-income kids who are getting a lot of preschool anyway to move ahead as well. What we tried to do in the book, it's not just a matter of preschool, yes or no. It's a matter of, again, the quality of the education experiences that are embedded in the preschool experience or in the elementary school experience or the high school experience. And what we feature in the book, all the education programs that we highlight are programs that have been proven to be effective with very rigorous kind of evaluations. And the Boston pre-K system was one such program that has been proven to be highly effective. So we did a case study, and we tried to find out how it came to be in its present form, what the classrooms look like, what the teacher supports look like. And again, you can get a vivid idea of what the classrooms look like and what these supports look like by looking at the Boston Pre-K video on the restoringopportunity.com website that we have.
Mm-hmm.
The pre-K system became much higher quality about 7 or 8 years ago when Jason Sachs became director of the Department of Early Childhood Education. He took over a system that where there were preschool classrooms. An evaluation showed that they were not very effective. And he came in and improved the quality of pre-K very dramatically in a number of ways. He put together a curriculum that, above all recognized that pre-kindergarten students learn through play. They're very active, so you don't want them sitting in desks and doing worksheets. You want them learning through what they do best, which is playing, fairly active activities. And he took a successful, proven math curriculum for pre-K and literacy curriculum for pre-K, combined it with a behavioral development curriculum. You want to allow kids to be active, but you also want to try to focus their attention on learning, and then manualized it, provided a lot of professional development for teachers, has a system of coaches who come in, really good coaches. There's Maria Boney is one of the coaches, and she's featured in the video, and you can see how carefully she observes a classroom and tries to develop ways of supporting the teachers to support the kids' learning. So it's, some circle time, but a lot of activities that are geared toward whatever book they're reading. And in the course of engaging in those activities, they learn about shapes and numbers. They develop vocabulary. So it's teachers finding ways to support kids' learning that's happening as they play. And it's a very systematic kind of approach. The teachers, it takes some time for the teachers to learn it, but by the end of the school year, this system of activities that the kids have had fun engaging in are producing a really big improvement mm-hmm. in both their numeracy and literacy skills.
That's encouraging. Professor Murnane, did you want to add to that?
No, I think Greg's done a very nice job of describing that.
All right. Let me turn then to what I found fascinating here in your book, which is kind of your assessment of the challenges in closing the opportunity gap based on the underlying inequality and the various social issues that stem from that. And I was struck watching the PBS NewsHour this week. They did a report on a school, Hinckley High School in Aurora, Colorado. And the focus was not on the issue I'm about to talk about. They were talking about discipline and using a system of restorative justice as a substitute for suspension and the more traditional approaches to disciplining in school. But the principal was quoted on the piece as saying that when they started subsidizing breakfast and lunch for students from low-income families, that the number of physical altercations, fights in school, dropped exponentially. I can't cite the numbers, but it was by more than a factor of 10. And this just is one example of the intricacies and the complexities of educational outcomes depending on the varied situations of students, and we need to account for the varied situations of teachers, too. But the politics of education reform rarely take into account the kind of end-to-end picture. Would you agree?
Yes, I don't think we as a nation have fully understood and acknowledged and embraced the consequences for children's life chances of growing up in a very poor families, and how that plays out in schools to the detriment not only of them but of their classmates as well.
And let me quote from the book, "It'll be extraordinarily difficult to reverse the striking growth in inequality in educational outcomes in the U.S. Changes in the economy have ratcheted up the skills and educational attainments Americans need to earn a good living. These changes are likely to persist into the foreseeable future. Second, the same computer-based technological changes that make it essential for all children to master more demanding skills have also widened the gap between the opportunities of low-income and higher-income children to acquire these skills. High-income parents, most of whom have college degrees, can invest in their children's education by choosing where to live and which schools their children will attend, and by using their financial resources and knowledge to help their children acquire skills and knowledge beyond what is taught in school. In contrast, low-income parents, most of whom have no post-secondary education, lack the resources to provide for their children's education in the same ways." So when we look at the socioeconomic factors, in many ways, attempts to refine and improve our education policies are inextricably linked to these social factors that are often unaddressed on the political level. Professor Duncan, you first.
Well, you know, in the book, we do feature
these. Why don't you speak about the income stuff, Greg?
Yeah, right. We do address and feature in these case studies the three school settings, the preschool and the elementary school and then the high school. But we also have a chapter devoted to a family support program that we were intrigued by that has been proven effective. And it's been proven effective in showing that kids actually do better in school when certain supports are extended to the families. So this is a program called New Hope, and it ran in Milwaukee mm-hmm. in the 1990s and early 2000s. And the idea was, it was developed by the community, by a group of community organizers, and it was very work-based. It really saw work as being the path for betterment, not only for parents, but also for their kids. And what it tried to do is provide a set of supports that families needed to try to balance the work and family conundrum. I think everybody who has kids, whether low-income or high-income, faces this terrible time crunch and a lot of the pressures from trying to balance both, and that's especially difficult if you have a low level of income. So this program said for people who can show that they are working at least 30 hours a week, they're entitled to an earnings supplement that would bring family income above the poverty line. They were entitled to a child care subsidy. They were entitled to a health care subsidy. If they needed a temporary job in order to get the 30 hours because they didn't have the work experience, that was available. And this program was evaluated in an experimental kind of design, and what it found, not only was there more work in families that were qualifying for these benefits, but the kids were doing better too. They interviewed the teachers of the kids who were in the program and the teachers who were in the control group, and particularly these were the two highest poverty neighborhoods in Milwaukee, and the teachers were reporting, especially for the boys, and these were boys who were in middle childhood, third grade through seventh grade. The boys, in particular, were doing much better in terms not only of their behavior, but also in terms of their achievement, if they were in families that were supported by this family program. So I think we can't just think of schools as being the path toward higher achievement. We also need to think of ways of supporting families that indirectly will have this effect of promoting achievement.
Mm-hmm. Professor Murnane, you want to add something?
No, I think something I would like to talk about that I was where I thought you were going. It would be, is it possible through education to improve life chances for children in low-income families, and why is it so difficult, and what are reasons for at least cautious optimism? Is that a reasonable topic?
Yes, go right ahead. I'm interested.
So I think, there's no question, following up on what Greg said, that if we had a better social safety net, so we were able to support children in low-income families better than the nation currently does, that would be a huge help. But then thinking about, what can schools do? And I think there, as both of us have mentioned, we highlight these interventions that have some scale, that have some durability, that have been shown in really cutting-edge evaluations to improve outcomes for low-income kids. Now, I think that raises the question, why don't all low-income kids have access to high-quality education from early childhood on that looks like this? And clearly, there's lots of reasons that connected to the structure of education and the way funding is done and the short tenure of urban superintendents is a long list. But if you look for what might be sources of optimism, we see several, and we call them building blocks for an American solution for improving schools. And one would be to start with these existence proofs, these interventions that we highlight. They show that, in fact, it is possible. And it's not only, and these are not, again, single schools. There's lots of cases where single schools shine brightly in difficult circumstances for a short period of time, for a few years. Lots of media stories about those. But then when you look 5 years later, they're not doing so well. Often because the person who led them, that was really the driving light, got burned out, and the teachers got burned out. So these interventions we're talking about are different than that. They had systems that provided consistently strong school supports and accountability. And that combination is essential. One without the other doesn't do the job. So the first thing are these existence proofs. The second thing is we've learned a lot in the last 20 years from research about what has to happen at the school level to educate low-income children well. And a lot of these are displayed in the videos and described in our book. We know lots more about child development, adolescent development, what constitutes good teacher training, the importance of good curricula, what good curricula looks like. So we know a lot more. We also, I think, to the extent these Common Core standards survive, that's a step in the right direction as well. What we have not figured out how to do as a nation is to provide systems that develop systems that provide these consistently strong combination of school supports and sensible accountability to all schools. That's really what other nations have figured out how to do, and the U.S. has not. Now, one other source of possible encouragement there is a growing density of organizations, most of them not-for-profit organizations, that provide particular support services to schools. For example, Boston has a Boston Teacher Residency Program to train urban teachers. There's New Leaders for New Schools. There's a New York City teacher leadership program. So there's a growing density of these that have learned how to do particular things that a great many high-poverty schools need. Now, the challenge is developing the systems that allow high-poverty schools to have both the knowledge and the resources to take advantage of these services that are increasingly available.
Mm-hmm. Professor, I want to follow up because I was intrigued by what you said about how at times, you'll have a superintendent or a leader who makes a big impact and then they burn out. And I'm really curious about your current evaluation of the work of Michelle Rhee in Washington, D.C. She left Washington a couple of years ago. She married the mayor of Sacramento, and she's now kind of pushing some of her reform ideas on a broader scale. But I'd like to know your honest assessment of the dramatic changes that she did impose in the Washington schools, and if we have any indication of positive outcome at this stage.
Well, she didn't stay long enough. As you probably know, there was a change in the mayor.
Mm-hmm.
And the mayor who brought her in lost the election, and the new mayor pushed her out. And that was before you had a chance to see. So I think Michelle Rhee's tenure was characterized by very strong accountability. And what I don't know enough about the details of is the extent to which there was the investments and wise investments in building capacity. And I don't think she had a long enough tenure to really know what the long-term outcomes would have been.
Mm-hmm. All right, sir. Well, I want to thank you both for joining me for this discussion today. The new book is called Restoring Opportunity, subtitled The Crisis of Inequality and the Challenge for American Education. Our guests have been Greg J. Duncan, Distinguished Professor in the School of Education, University of California, Irvine, and Richard Murnane, who is the Thompson Professor of Education and Society at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Thanks for listening to this conversation about education policy and reform. I welcome your feedback. Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.